Dive into the world of dance at the Victorian College of the Arts. Their program offers a unique blend of artistry, performance, and a choreographic practice within an inclusive environment. As an undergraduate student, you explore contemporary dance, physical theatre, ballet, urban dance, and more in a collaborative studio lab setting. At honors level, specialize in performance skills, choreographic practice, or dance research. Plus, benefit from the proximity of local choreographers and companies including Philip Adams, Stephanie Lay Company, Lucy Guerin, Chunky Move, and Dance House. Through professional placements, their students have the opportunity to develop pathways for their future careers through these relationships and networks. Consider a variety of bachelor, master's, and even doctorate programs available according to your needs. Join them and unleash your artistic potential at the Victorian College of the Arts. Learn more through the link in the descriptions below. Hello and welcome to The Background Dancer. I'm your host, Jason Yup. Thank you for joining me with our community of passionate dance contributors from around the world and across different fields. In this weekly podcast, I offer educational conversations and insightful tips to help you better understand all things offstage about this curious art form. For this episode, we continue our forays into art management and explore what it means to be a producer in the performing arts. My guest today is Bilkis Hijaz. She is an educator, choreographer, art critique, and independent producer based in Malaysia. Most notably, she was also the president of My Dance Alliance, a support membership organization advocating contemporary dance, as well as the Malaysian extension of the World Dance Alliance Global Network. Hello, Bilkis, and welcome to the podcast. It's such a pleasure to have you here, not only as a fellow Malaysian, but also somebody whose works I have admired and appreciated ever since I took my first steps into dance back in Malaysia. So welcome, Bilkis.
Thank you so much, Jason. It's really good to be here.
As you know, the month of March will be focused on art management, and you, as an independent producer, have been at it for such a long time, more than a decade, I believe. So to begin with, Bilkis, what exactly is a producer?
Well, there are many different answers to this question. I usually define a theatre producer as someone who makes all of the decisions that are not the artistic decisions. So that might be the decisions relative to the venue, to sales of tickets, to marketing the show to the audience, to hiring the cast members, to hiring the technical team, and to overseeing the flow of the development of the project in rehearsal and also then in performance, but not having any say over artistic choices.
Recently, there is the emergence now of something called a creative producer as well, right? So what is that?
Again, it's one of those terms that comes with a lot of different territory, and many people, you know, define it very differently as well. I have occasionally been described as a creative producer, and I think it comes with the territory of developing and designing your own frameworks in which the artistic works then appear. So as a creative producer, you are not directly responsible for the artistic work itself, but you might be responsible for either developing the theme of, say, an overarching festival, or for choosing artistic collaborators who will then work together to create a new piece. So you are creating the framework in which the piece is developed, but not actually directing the development of the piece itself.
So somebody who maybe stands in between the artistic aspect and all the other things, the dirty work, right? This is something that I commonly understand about the role.
Well, I don't know. As a producer, I feel like it's often within our remit to do a lot of the dirty work. It depends on how big of a institution you are operating in. So in very big institutions that are very well resourced, which have very clear structures and hierarchies, you might have much more distinctive job descriptions. So there will be the producer, and then there'll be the production manager, and then there'll be separate teams for marketing and for, you know, stage management and all that kind of thing. But if you're basically a one man or one woman show, you might be doing all of those things in just one person. So in that case, you do have to get your hands dirty. And there have been many times when I have certainly been called in. In many cases, the producer is the one who's sort of sitting at the top of the totem pole without making the artistic decisions. So if anything goes wrong, the buck stops there. And they're the ones who have to figure out some kind of a solution.
I myself am an aspiring producer. I hope one day when I transition to my post-performance career, it would involve something similar, either as a producer, creative producer, curator, manager, whatever you call it. So for you, who is becoming a producer most suitable for?
I think people who are very comfortable with solving problems, because basically production is a sequence of problems, practical problems that just are waiting to be solved. So firstly, you need to have a venue. You don't have a venue. How are you going to find one? How are you going to pay for it? You don't have an audience. How are you going to find an audience? How are you going to identify them, invite them, reach out to them, price the tickets accordingly so that they're accessible to them? You don't initially have perhaps a show unless you are working specifically for another artist, and they are already developing the show. So you might be, in fact, inviting the artist to be part of the show that you're developing. And I feel that there are particular people who are very capable both in solving problems and also identifying them, because it's a lot about seeing the problem before it becomes a problem and stepping in and going, yeah, I can perhaps not know how to fix that, but I can perhaps provide some kind of suggestion for where we might go from here. And that's pretty much it with producing. I mean, you can these days do an arts management degree, but you'll still often find that many people who are working in arts management are, you know, exactly like you and me. We have worked in other areas, dancers or choreographers who then become producers. And so they don't have a background in arts management. So you start by doing, and you learn by doing. And you basically just jump in the deep end and say, I'm going to produce a show. It's always easier if you start off with something fairly small and more manageable. You don't want to kill yourself on your first go round. And it's good to have mentors and people who can advise you and kind of guide you through some of the sticky bits. But basically, there's no way to learn how to do it without just doing it. And you, as a dancer who has been in various shows, you're already sort of familiar with the way that this works. Okay, maybe you're not in the room when the stage manager gets hired, but you know that there is a stage manager. You know basically what the stage manager is responsible for doing. They might also do a lot of things that you're not even aware of, but you already have familiarity with the way that all of this works. So you just have to put yourself in the position of going, okay, I'm the person at the top who has to make all of the decisions, and then feel capable of making those decisions. Of course, many wrong decisions are made. That's all part of the learning process. And again, you have to start small and build yourself up. But I think you'll find that most people who are working as producers have done it just like that.
Another aspect I believe producers should have is flexibility, adaptability to not only the artist, but the context they're working in. So you already mentioned that most of these dancers transition to producers. What about the other way around? What about people who have never had a dance background? One of the intentions of the background dancer also is to introduce to people who have never had that experience to go, it's okay, you can be part of our world. In fact, we want you to be part of our world, right? So what do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, production is kind of starting at the top. So I'm not sure that that's where someone who had absolutely no experience of the dance world would want to begin. But certainly other people who are in the stage world, so for example, people who are lighting designers or lighting technicians or stage hands even, again, are familiar with the basic flow of the way a performance works. And yeah, there's no reason why they couldn't also step in and decide, I would like to produce my own little show. It's then just a question of selecting the artists or being already in touch with particular artists that you know you want to work with and offering your services to them. I think in the beginning, when people start out doing production in the same way as when people start out choreographing, you're not doing it for money because you have to prove the fact that you're capable of doing this, and you need to have a couple of shows under your belt before people are going to trust the fact that, you know, you're reasonably capable of performing under the job description. So, you know, it's the best idea is to start off in the beginning thinking, okay, I'm going to have a small show with your friends. That's always a good place to start. And, you know, a mixed bill is always easier than a single full-length work. So maybe three short works of 20 minutes each. You're going to find a small venue. It seats 100 people. It could just be a sort of studio theater, or it could just be a studio and people can sit on the floor and you don't even have any lighting. And, you know, you can start off without even having any tickets. So people just rock up and sit on the floor and watch the show. I mean, that in its very bare bones sense is the smallest that you can break a show down to, but that's a great way to kind of get your feet wet and to start understanding all of the moving parts. Because the problem is there are lots of moving parts and they've all got to come together in this seamless production, which is the performance. And organizing that is one of the great challenges of being a producer. I remember when I started out, I really had no idea, again, what I was doing. Most of it was learning on the job. And in the first couple of shows, I was the producer, I was the choreographer, I was, on certain insane occasions, also one of the dancers. I was responsible for marketing. I was selling tickets at the door. I was like, we didn't have a stage manager. So basically, I was the stage manager. Now, this is a level of insane that I don't necessarily recommend to anyone, but it's highly useful for figuring out all of the jobs that need to be done to get a show on stage. And also figuring out that, you know, you can do all of them, but you shouldn't want to and you shouldn't have to. So as you get better at your job, you will hopefully also acquire the resources to be able to either hire or finagle other people into doing those jobs for you. And then really the skill that you need to practice is not so much the multitasking, which was really required in the beginning, but delegation of responsibility. And a lot of people, especially very capable people, can find that very hard because they see problems and they just want to jump in and say, okay, I can fix that. I'll fix that right now. But is it really your job to be plugging in the electrical appliance? Is it really your job to be ironing the costume? If you have someone else who's been hired to do that or who is responsible for that, they should be doing it. So you need to step back and allow other people to do their jobs. That can be challenging, especially in a very small context. But again, you come into production to learn sort of all the facets of making a show come on stage. And then gradually, as you sort of work your way up the ladder, you can delegate all of those responsibilities so that then in an ideal world, you're at the top, you're giving directions, and there's a team of people who are following your direction.
As a producer, you also produce a bevy of different disciplines and different spaces. How does a dance producer specifically differ from other disciplines?
It differs very much from being a music producer. And I think this is where a lot of people, especially in this day and age, get a little bit confused. If you say you're a dance producer and like, exactly what is that? When a music producer is like in the credits of a song itself, a music producer, from what I can tell, is much more responsible for the actual artistic construction of, say, a pop song. It's different, again, from being a film producer, where when you're a film producer, it's often, especially if you have things like executive producers, it's often just about finding the money. because film is so incredibly expensive. So usually you need to have multiple producers coming in for the single job. And for most of those producers, they're not actually managing the project. They're just finding the money so that the project can go ahead. So it's different from film producing. Dance producing is really just doing the mechanics of getting the show on stage. I don't know about other production. It's quite similar to theatrical production and to sort of musical theater production. But in terms of like comparing it to production of, say, arts, visual arts exhibitions and fairs, that requires quite a different set of skills. So it differs from that a great deal. But in terms of performing art production, it's pretty much the same skill, I would say, across the board.
So as a producer whose works are mostly focused around the Southeast Asian as well as entire Asian region, we probably deal a lot with multiplicity, plurality, diversity of cultures. How has that aspect influenced the way you work with artists as well as the spaces that you engage with?
Hey, Jason here with a special message for you to help and continue serving our beloved performing arts community. So here's what you can do. Share this with one person you believe who this episode can benefit and attach a personal note explaining why. This way, you are not only helping me grow this show, but also adding value to those you truly care about. Massive appreciation, as it means the world to me. And let's get right back to the show.
I guess this points more in my towards my identity as a creative producer in the kinds of platforms that I create for shows, in which a lot of the time it is about having very diverse artists on the same stage. So, say, in the same festival or in the same show. And in Malaysia, that's not very difficult to do within the contemporary dance context, because there are so many different communities who are coming to contemporary dance from very different directions and have very different forms and understandings of what contemporary dance means. So it's easy to, even if you're just saying, okay, this is Malaysian contemporary dance, to put it on stage and see things that are extremely different from each other. And that usually has to do with language groups and different ethnicities. In that way, I think you have to be quite familiar with all of the different dance forms that you're working with, or at least familiar enough to understand some of the technical requirements or the norms that exist within those different genres. So, you know, to give a very obvious example, if you are presenting classical ballet on stage and the dancers are going to be on point, it's very important that you have a certain floor surface. And it's the producer's responsibility to ensure that that floor surface is provided and that it is safe. Then there are other dancers who may be wearing shoes during their performance, or they may be barefoot, but they need to be able to hear the percussive nature of their dance on stage. And so they might require a different kind of surface. Or, for example, in Indian classical dance and in many also contemporized forms of Indian dance, it's very much the norm to have extremely colorful lights. Which is less so in the context of sort of Western-oriented contemporary dance. It also is often the norm, especially with Indian classical dance, to have a god sculpture on stage to which the dancers prostrate themselves before the performance begins in order to ask the blessings of the god before they perform. And so you have to understand that this is the context in which it's usually performed, and then make the decisions. Is this the context that you want it performed on your stage now, knowing that you're going to have classical ballet and Bharatanatyam back to back? Is there a way they can use the same floor? Is there a way that you can bring in the god's idol from stage right and move it out again before the ballet dancers come in? So there are things like that where it helps to be a little understanding of where all the different dance forms are coming from. And also, just in terms of language, at least in Malaysia, it's always quite difficult because many people are working from many different first languages. So recently I have preferred to kind of delegate agents in particular languages who are part of my production team, who, for example, speak Mandarin, or who, for example, are Malay and speak Malay better than I do, not that hard, and who can relate culturally to the way that those artists are operating. Because also there is there are lots of issues which can become quite sensitive about whether someone is required to ask for something or whether they that thing will just be provided to them, and, you know, do you lose face by asking for it? In a Western context, which tends to be a very ask-oriented context, you need something and you ask for it and then you get it. In many Asian contexts, it's more a bit like you kind of suss out whether or not you can get it without actually directly asking for it, because you don't want to be put in a position where someone has to say no. So you have to be aware that these different types of communication is going to be happening at the same time in a very large group of people. So you have to be quite sensitive to everyone's different approaches. And it can help to have native speakers helping with the sort of negotiation of that.
I'm speaking with Bilqis Hijaz, initiator of Critiques Republic, a writer's community promoting and advocating for art criticism in Malaysia. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we continue exploring the best parts as well as the most challenging ones of being a dance producer. Among the host of dance programs realized by Bilqis at the Rimbun Dahan Art Center in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, include the Southeast Asian Choreolab Residency, the site-specific production Dancing in Place, and the My Dance Festival. So you already mentioned scales, right? And as with everything, I do believe there are levels to producing. There are people who would maybe apply the all-or-nothing approach, and then there are some who really look into the nuances. So what do you think about the democratization of this role? Because I probably can produce something in my backyard and call it a production. Does that make me a producer?
But it's also like the question of what makes a dancer, right? Which it comes with its own group of...
Yes.
Yeah, it's very difficult to really pin down these things. Is a dancer a professional? I don't know. I didn't initially use it, but that was because I was initially using the label of choreographer, which looking back, I feel like I had even less claim to. But then eventually other people started referring to me as a producer, and I found it to be quite a useful catch-all term for all of the things that I was doing. And because I was doing many different things, it was difficult for me to say, okay, now I'm a this and now I'm a that, and now with this project, I'm a something else. So yeah, fine, I'm a producer. That just works for everything. I don't think people are that precious about defending the territory of what a producer is, or at least not in my experience. I've never heard of anyone saying, oh God, you know, so-and-so calls themselves a producer, but oh, can you imagine, really, that person, a producer? Well, at least in Malaysia, where we're not so professionalized, we are very tolerant of anyone taking on any labels that they want to. If anyone wants to call themselves a producer, they're perfectly welcome to, I think.
And have you actually met people who really defend that? Because I have, and maybe not necessarily a producer, but for example, something as prestigious or as specific as a curator. It's like, oh, you know, you can only call me one if I've done something, or I am one. You should remember that.
I think, again, in situations in which there is an extremely complex hierarchy involved and a very established institution in which it's very clear that there are certain roles and certain responsibilities that go with certain extremely exact roles. And everyone is a very particular cog in a much, much larger and much more complex machine. Then I suppose it's fair enough to make small distinctions between these positions. But in Malaysia, again, where we don't have this kind of degree of professionalization and where it's so very, very normal for people to be wearing multiple hats. So I wear hats as producer, as residency manager, which is, I think, quite different, as critic, which is very different, as lecturer and teacher, which is again quite different. And most people in Malaysia who are in the performing arts are doing this. They don't have a single title. So I think we here are quite flexible with that kind of multiple hat wearing. But in other contexts, I could see they might be a little bit more sensitive about this.
So with any job in any role, there comes criticism. What are some that are commonly directed at producers? And if any, have you ever been criticized as a producer? Hey everyone, if you're like me and prioritize online privacy and security, you're going to love NordVPN. Not only does NordVPN safeguard your internet connection and protect your personal data from hackers and snoopers, but it also offers an amazing advantage: seamless access to geo-blocked content on platforms like Netflix. With NordVPN, you can browse the web with peace of mind and enjoy your favorite shows and movies from anywhere in the world. Plus, their user-friendly interface makes it easy for anyone to stay protected online. And here's the best part. NordVPN offers a 30-day money-back guarantee, so you can try it risk-free. Trust me, I've been using this for 2 years now, and it has totally changed my life. What's more, you can get the basic plan for as low as $5 a month. By signing up through the referral link below, you not only support your online peace of mind, but also help me and the continuity of this show. So, sign up for NordVPN today and let's serve smarter and safer together.
I think the biggest challenge for many producers is retaining a very trusting and supportive relationship with the artist that you're working with. And if you get out of the show, and despite the fact that the show may have been great and the product was amazing and the audience really liked it and the critics thought it was wow, if you don't still have that respectful, trusting relationship with the artist that you're working with and you've really burned all your bridges, then there's obviously something wrong with the way that you work. And I don't think anyone can say who's done a lot of productions that they are really on great terms with everyone that they've worked with before. But certainly it is the challenge of a producer to try, at least within the remit of the production itself, to try and be as supportive of the creative team as possible. I mean, the comparison that is often used in this context, the classic comparison is, you know, the artist says jump and the producer says how high. The artist says, I want a purple elephant and I want it here tomorrow morning. And the producer, you know, has a quiet little heart attack and goes backstage and finds that purple elephant. And that is what the producer is supposed to do. I found, though, in my context, again, especially in Malaysia, where we're working with very low budgets and we're working with small works in small contexts, artists are very understanding of the fact that we all have great limitations and that certain things cannot be done within those limitations. And I try to make it very clear to the artists who are involved what the limitations are before they even begin. So, okay, your light set is going to look like this. We're probably only going to have three colors. If you're not okay with that, I completely understand. You might not want to be part of this show, and that's fine. No hard feelings. Another thing that I think is difficult, especially for producers who are starting out in the beginning, is talking about money. Malaysians in some ways are very bad about talking about money. We're very good at asking other people how much they earn. For some reason, that is fine. But then negotiating the actual deal of, like, I'm asking you to do such and such, and for that, I'm going to pay you such and such. For some reason, this becomes completely impossible. But I think it's so much more respectful and easy to be able to say to the artist in the very beginning, look, I'm either going to pay you 5,000 ringgit to be in this show, or there is no budget. We're all doing this for free. We're all volunteers. No one is going to get paid. Are you okay with that? And if you're not, again, no hard feelings. Thank you for even considering it. But obviously, it's not right for you to be in this show. It's fine, I think, in Malaysia, in today's context, to be hiring people, not hiring because you're not paying them. It's fine to be using people in productions without paying them, because we do not have the kind of established infrastructure that other industries, creative industries, and other places have. There are, of course, many, again, pros and cons to this idea of whether you should ever work if you are not getting paid. But I think, quite frankly, in Malaysia, with the way that our funding situation is at the moment, and by the way, it's a lot better than it used to be, you know, if we're all waiting to get paid before we can dance, we're gonna be old and crippled before we're even going to be able to get on stage. So if you ever want to be dancing, the reality is that I don't get paid often as a producer, and they're not going to get paid as dancers. We're all going to produce something that we're all very proud of. It's unfortunate that we can't get paid, but that's the reality of our industry right now. I think that's one of the more challenging parts of being a producer. I don't feel like I've particularly been criticized in my role as being a producer. I think in the larger scene, there has been quite a lot of interest in the role of the producer, and especially in the role of the creative producer, especially in the Asian region, within the last 10 years or so. And there have been many producers coming together in international contexts, talking to each other, forming networks, forming support systems, trading information, knowledge. And a lot of international events have sprung up which cater towards these producers. So I'm thinking AppCamp, Asian Producers Platform, TPAM, Tokyo Performing Arts Meeting in Yokohama, and coming down to smaller events like BPAM, Bangkok Performing Arts Meeting, and other things where there are many specific conversations that are led by and are designed for producers. And it has come to my attention that there are some artists who feel that they're being marginalized by this sudden focus on the producer as one of the linchpins of this entire creative process, and that they feel that because the producer is not the creative, the main creative driver, there should not be that much emphasis on that role, because that role is essentially a support role. I mean, a lot of the networks that have come up for producers have been started by producers for themselves. I mean, I think it's a little mean to say that we can't start our own support networks for ourselves if we need them. And obviously, we do need them. Do the artists also need support networks? Absolutely. They're also quite capable of forming these support networks by themselves, or maybe they are waiting for people like producers to help them with that. Yeah, I don't know that I have that much time for this kind of criticism. I understand that artists may feel that they have been marginalized, but I also think that it is somewhat of a passing trend, and I think focuses will shift. As at some point, the whole idea of the dramaturg, for example, became really important, and that was, you know, trendy and exciting, and everybody wanted to pour attention into that. And that's just the way that it is within the performing arts, that things become trendy and then stop being trendy. So if you don't like the fact that producers' networks at the moment or in the last 10 years have been given quite a lot of salience, then wait a couple of years and they'll be gone. So it's fine.
Okay, I will tell you a little story. When I first started delving into curation, producing, I was very fascinated by it, and of course, really developed an interest. And I asked my lecturer at the time, I said, hey, is there any way that I can travel as a producer, you know, like all these artists do, and meet other business-minded people and talk to them? And he said, no. Nobody commissions producers. They commission the artists, and then the artists bring their producers along, right? And it's wonderful to actually see the emergence of all these different platforms, because yes, there is a lot more democratization, like I said, about who is important to the machination of the art. So very challenging indeed, but what are the best parts about being a producer?
Getting this show on stage and knowing that it wouldn't have happened without you. I mean, obviously, it doesn't happen without the artist. Obviously, it doesn't happen without the support of the smallest person who is involved in the very smallest way. But it is really wonderful to see all of these separate decisions that you make over a long period of time, putting together a team, finding the right venue, negotiating bureaucracy, which can be extremely onerous, and having that actually coalesce into a show with ticket-paying audiences and a production that you're really proud of. And there's nothing like that. It's really such a rush. And in a way, it comes without the kind of anxiety that attends the creative decision. So when a show goes on stage, yeah, it's the finished product, but for the choreographer, it's still a moment of extreme anxiety. What will the audience think? What will the critics say? But for the producer, like, the show went on stage, all the cues got run, nobody died, and, you know, that's a success. I don't care what the critics say. it's a wonderful moment to realize that you can make these things happen. And also, I think, because, again, as people who have loved art and whose lives have been changed by going to see shows, to be part of that process and know that you are putting shows forward to people that they can enjoy and that may change their lives, and also providing platforms for dancers and performers and artists that really support them in their own creative directions. I mean, there's so much sense of achievement in being able to offer that to people on both sides of the footlights.
Yes, there's certainly a level of satisfaction when you empathize for the artists and the people in the production team, right? Like, for once, okay, I was not on stage, but I enabled them to become or to fulfill their fullest potential. I was like, wow, this is sometimes even more fulfilling than being an artist and being a performer. So that's strange. But what advice would you offer to people like me, let's say, who are in the earlier stages of starting their production careers or interests?
I would say just to get a group of supportive and like-minded people around you and just jump in and do a little show and build your way up from there. There's nothing like learning on the job. And yeah, you're going to make a couple of mistakes along the way, but it's not really, again, nobody dies. It's okay. We'll all live and see tomorrow. That's perfectly fine. We all learn. I think it is important to find mentors within the industry who can help you navigate certain particularly prickly bits. So when I first started producing, I was very lucky to have people at KL Performing Arts Center, specifically Ian Chow, who's the theater manager. And he talked me through the whole process of applying for an entertainment license and all of the kind of taxation issues and the bureaucracy that is involved in putting on a play in Kuala Lumpur, which I am now quite au fait with, I have to say. So if anyone needs a lowdown on the bureaucracy of putting on a show in the Klang Valley, I would be happy to talk to you. And that was really, really helpful to have an advisor in that position. You know, they're not doing any of the work, but they can really give you a lot of background that can help you avoid pitfalls.
What do you want people to say or think about you when you're 90 years old, for example?
That is a difficult question. But going back to what you mentioned earlier about being an enabler, the producer being an enabler for artists, I think that's very true. And actually, when I first started being a producer who was not producing my own choreographic work, it was because I was so frustrated with what I felt were the shortcomings of my own choreographic work. I didn't like the dances I was making, and I didn't think I was a very good choreographer. I still don't. And yet I saw around me other people who had incredible amounts of talent, much more than I had. And I thought how wonderful it would be just to enable them to make their shows instead of putting all of this effort into my mediocre offering. Wouldn't it be better to enable people who have lots of talent and lots of potential? And the thrill of being able to do that and being able to help other people realize their potential never goes away. And I hope that when I am 90, there'll be a lot of people within the industry, and I think not just within dance, but within the wider performing arts industry, who will be able to look back and say, yeah, I was in a show that she produced, and it gave me an opportunity to do something that was an important or was a key part of my artistic development. And it's nice to think that you can touch a lot of people's lives, specifically artists' lives, and also to be touching many people in the audience and their lives in ways that you can't particularly quantify, but are certainly there nevertheless.
So final question, a bit like a rapid fire one, actually. Since The Background Dancer is a podcast about dance and also hopefully inviting people to be part of our dance world, what makes a dancer for you?
I think if you want to call yourself a dancer, you can call yourself a dancer, and it's not anybody else's business whether you do or not. It's up to you.
Thank you so much, Bilkis. It has been such a pleasure to have you on the Background Dancer. Hopefully this is the start of many more dialogues that we can continue to have for our communities as well as for the wider art ecosystem.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
My guest today has been Bilkis Hijaz. She is an educator, choreographer, art critique, and independent producer based in Malaysia with the likes of Critiques Republic, Rimbundahan Art Center, and My Dance Alliance. Check out the show notes for more information regarding Bilkis as well as her affiliations. And if you have not done so already, hit the subscribe button and reach out to me either via email, Facebook, Instagram, or subscribe to the email list to receive notifications regarding future content. Do join the Facebook group as well and be a part of our growing Background Dancers community. In the next episode, we conclude our month of art management by exploring more managerial roles such as art administrator, curator, festival programmer, so on and so forth. Appreciate your time once again. Have a great week. And stay healthy. Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode. Be sure to subscribe, comment, and leave a review on your designated podcast and social media platforms. If you found this interesting or helpful, feel free to share with members of your community so that they too may connect with us in our quest to foreground dance in the background. I'm Jason Yup of The Background Dancer, and as always, catch you next time. If you're listening to this, you are most definitely a dance enthusiast, maybe even one for dance science. Well, why not join the International Association for Dance Medicine and Science, or IADEMS for short, and become part of a global community dedicated to supporting dancers and performers worldwide. With active members from over 50 countries, including experts in dance, medicine, and science, IADEMS provides a diverse network of support and resources. As a member, you'll gain access to exclusive benefits such as discounts to year-round events, their vast collection of e-learning opportunities, and a subscription to the Journal of Dance Medicine and Science, amongst other incredible and unique offers. Join the mission for better outcomes and apply for an IADEMS membership today. Click the link in the descriptions below for more info.